Special warm greeting to each of you this evening to have gathered in for this first session here. We're not doing deep theological things. We'd like to be obedient to what God says in Psalm 78. So if you would turn quickly to Psalm 78. God is a storyteller. He starts out his book in the book of Genesis with the creation story. And then he moves into the story of how sin came into the world. He talks about what happened with the flood. We have the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all those stories. And we go through the Old Testament. Exodus is partly story. Numbers, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, almost entirely story. And there's a few other things in the Old Testament as well. And then we come to the New Testament time, and God breaks into the human story with his own son, and we have four more stories called the Gospels. And then we have the book of Acts, and then the canon closes. But we've had 2,000 years since that time, and I do think God wants us to pay attention to what he says in Psalm 78 and tell that story as well. He says in Psalm 78, I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Now, I would understand those verses to include both teaching the law, what God expected, and also telling the story. And I just need to say right up front that we Anabaptist people have not done so well on this. We have not told our story well, let alone even tell the story. And so I feel bad about that, and I would like to do something about that at this week. You folks live in Kansas. And at one time, Kansas had the highest Mennonite population of all the states. And who is here tonight of a Dutch-Russian extraction? One. We are privileged to have one. Okay. Where's the other one? There. We've got two, at least two. Okay. Well, this week is to tell their story. Most of us here tonight are of the Swiss-German kind of Anabaptist, and what we're going to talk about is the Dutch-Russian version. And so we're going to tell their story. And we want to learn lessons from their story. Now, I have to tell you that I have told this story, and some parts of this story are not very pleasant. And somebody from the Dutch-Russian tradition got kind of upset with me because I'm telling their story and the Swiss Germans have as many problems on their side as we have. And I acknowledge that. It's just that the scriptures are unique. They're a solid literature because they have not only told the victories, but they've also told the failures of the people. And so I would like to be fair with you and tell you of the victories and the failures of these people. Do you know that in the Dutch-Russian side of the story, there are two skeletons in the closet? I'm going to make reference to one of those skeletons tonight. And on Wednesday night, I would like to tell a full version of the other skeleton. This skeleton is so hideous that nobody's wanted to talk about it. People seem free to talk about the first skeleton, but the second skeleton, when I went to research this, the librarian said, Obviously, this is not the kind of thing we put out front. But we do need to know the story. So Wednesday night, I'm going to tell the story. And Wednesday night, we're going to have Brother Linford serve first. And then I cannot tell you all in the time allotment, so I'm going to tell you up front, I plan to run over Wednesday night and wait. You're going to have to sit still until I'm finished. But I need to tell you this story, and I can't stop partway through. And it's not a nice story. If you don't want to hear a terrible story, then don't come Wednesday night. All right, I'm going to speak down on the floor here because I have a number of overheads I need to share with you. Is there any way we could have these front lights off? Thank you, that's appreciated. You might raise the question, why not tell our own story? Why must we tell our cousin's story? Well, the simple answer is sometimes we learn better from the cousins than we do ourselves because our own story is too close to us. So if it's one step removed, just maybe we can hear it a little better. First of all, I would like to, I'm an educator, please pardon me, but as I said, we have not done well in telling our story. But the ultimate test of any civilization is what it does with its children. The Christian school is tasked with instilling the worldview that all of life is sacred. When students wonder, grasp truth, love all people, and find personal security, all by sitting at the feet of the master teacher and his human agents, they find life to be meaningful and full of purpose. And it's very true of history. Two history professors sitting and commiserating. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Yet those who do study history are doomed to stand by helplessly while everyone else repeats it. Again, too true. To locate this story geographically, all of us here, except for two, most of us here, except for two, have roots here in Switzerland. This gives the birth date of Anabaptism in 1525. Well, just about 10 years later, Anabaptism was birthed in Holland. Now, these two peoples are completely separate peoples. And their stories are almost completely separate, although they do touch. And one of the things that we are forever indebted to the Dutch-Russian people was when we got pushed out of Europe, I'll show you something here shortly, these people had experienced the end of their persecution earlier and had gotten wealthy, and we were desperately poor, and they paid our way to America. And we're forever grateful to these people for doing that. Okay, so you notice that these people had some migration this way, but the ones that are sitting here this evening all came this way at one time or another. But we're not going to follow this story. We're going to follow this story, and you'll notice that under persecution, these people moved east instead of west. While we went west, these people went east. This is the story of Menno Simon's people. I should tell you right up front, the only two people sitting here tonight are really Mennonites. The rest of us aren't really Mennonites. I'm sorry, I'm serious. We are Swiss brethren. We got called Mennonite because these people paid our way over here, and when the Swiss government wanted to know who we are and what we believe, we gave them the Dortrecht Confession, which is not even our own confession. And so we got called Mennonites, and the name has stuck, and we are living with it today. But we're really not Mennonites. It's all these people up here in Newton and that are populated up north of here. They are the real Mennonites, including the two that are here tonight. Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, when we decided we need to sign something, so we signed the Dortrich even though we didn't completely agree with it. I'm sorry. This made a huge issue. Jacob Ammon, that's one of the reasons for the Amish separation. Jacob Ammon says to our people, why aren't we doing what's in this statement? We didn't practice feet washing. The Dortrich Confession said we did. And we didn't practice strict shunning, but the Dortrich Confession said we did. And one of the other ironies of history is that after this whole thing settled and the Amish separation happened, in 1702, we did publish our own version. And it's called the 19 Articles. Because if you get it out, and if you have the book Golden Apples and Silver Bowls, you can read it. You can put it right beside your Dortrich Confession, and you can see the difference. One of the most obvious differences is that the Dortrich Confession has no statement on the Holy Spirit. So we added that. There's a whole statement on the Holy Spirit. It's called the 19 Articles. And also, as a result of what had just happened, they put other things in and they took some things out. And one of the things that they put in was an expression of the necessity of fiery love among the brethren. Wow. So, bless Leonard Gross, he rescued this book. It's never been out of print in German, but it's been out of print many years. And finally, in 1999, the Mennonite Historical Society reprinted this book and sold it for $25, and within a few years, it went out of print again. And you could buy it on Amazon for $1,100. And so they put it back into print again. And as I speak this evening, I think the publisher only has about 5 books left. I know somebody who wanted to buy the rest of the books, and they would not sell them. It's like going out of print. If you're a bookseller, we're only selling it to people who want them one at a time. So I don't know what the price is going to turn into. So if you have a Golden Apples and Silver Bowls, you are a privileged person. Anybody have one? Oh, several of you. Bless your hearts. Okay. Thank you. If you have something else to say like that, just stop me and raise a question, anything that's on your mind. Yes. Yes, it is. That's part of the story. I can't tell all the story. I mean, the job of a teacher is to work itself out of a job. Okay, since he brought this up, some of you might have this book. Okay? So read it. Open it up and read it. That's the cup and the cross. Okay? And this is a real readable version by Cornelius Dick. This is kind of like the standard introduction to Mennonite history. This happens to be the 3rd edition. This has pictures in, and I'm going to show you one of the pictures tonight. It has to do with the first skeleton in the closet. Also, here's another pretty good one, Through Fire and Water, Overview of Mennonite History. This includes both our story, the Swiss-German story, but it also includes the Dutch-Russian story. So does this one, for that matter. And so does this one, for that matter. All right. My favorite one is this one. Smith's Story of the Mennonites, but it's the 5th edition. This book keeps getting bigger and bigger, and again, it covers both stories. But it's very readable, and it seems like every so often there's a new edition bringing it up to date. Now, If you have an Amish background, most likely you started out. Right there, Bern. That's where you came from. Now, I have no Amish background, and so I started out, my people started out, it's not on here. Yeah, right there, Zurich. Right there. And I don't want to go into all that story, but anyway, you'll notice these are significant things about this geography. The Anabaptist movement began in January 21, 1525. That's usually what's said, although there's a question of starting at several places. I think it's also true. The Waldensians had prepared the soil, the spiritual soil, out of which Anabaptism grew. It was not a brand new movement that just sprang up on the face of the earth. There was something that was lingering in the hearts and minds of people. People knew by instinct and by teaching and by hearing that there is something more than what the Roman Catholic Church was teaching. And so once it got started, many, many people rallied to it. Okay, now, this is a subject in itself, the Schleitheim Confession. How many of you have one of these? It would be interesting to just talk for a while on this one. This is very significant. It talks about six articles, but it really gave some cohesion to the scattered movements of people. Anytime something new starts, it's very diverse and unsettled and unstable. This brought stability. It was written by Michael Sattler, and he died a martyr's death soon after writing this. Okay. The Hutterite people that you see over here in Moravia, there are three brands of Anabaptists. It's the Amish Mennonites over here. And if you've ever heard of George Blaurock, he went east, and it's out of his influence that the Hutterite movement was born. And that's a fascinating story. But they went over to Moravia, and they have a completely separate story. But once again, they owe a debt to the Dutch-Russian people for rescuing them. They probably would not have survived if it wouldn't have been for Johann Cornies seeing their plight and moving them down into near the Russian communities north of the Black Sea. And whenever the first migration of those Russian Mennonites to America happened, all the Hutterites left Russia and settled in South Dakota. And so we have all kinds of Hutterites today. Okay, up here is Menno Simons area, Witmarsum. I should tell you a little story. My dad and my son and I were traveling one day. Actually, we were going to Liberia, and we had a little bit of time. I think Brother Yoder, Dan Yoder, loaned us his car so we could do some traveling. And we drove around, and one of the things I wanted to see was Dordrecht. I wanted to see where this thing was written. I'm totally ignorant over there. And so we got his car, and you can drive down the road, and big signs, it says Dordrecht. So we went to Dordrecht. Well, where in the world did the Dordrecht Confession get written? So I have no idea. So I stopped a policeman. I said, where's the Mennonite church in Dordrecht? Mennonite? He didn't know of any Mennonite. So I talked to him a little bit more, and he said, Doopsgezinde. Yeah, Doopsgezinde. Oh, be patient. So he got on the phone and talked to somebody. He says, get off the phone. He says, follow me. So I went, followed right behind that police car, and he took me straight to Dordrecht Church. Now, that Dordrecht Church, I don't think was the original one. It looked like a pretty new one to me. But I felt pleased to be able to go and see where this happened, because it was a significant thing. And then we went up the road even further, up here to Pingham. Pingham isn't mentioned on here. Witmarsum is. But Pingham is the Catholic church where Menno Simons first began his ministry. And lo and behold, they're having a service in there. It's because it was Ascension Day. And I didn't know it. I guess Dan knows, but all Europe shuts down on Ascension Day. It's a holiday. And so We timidly knock on the door and open it and look inside, and people caught our eye and went like this. Woo! I wasn't sure what to do. So we waited for a while, opened up a door again, and they called like this. So we went in, and there was a man standing up in the pulpit where Menno Simons used to preach. And he was preaching in Dutch, and I didn't understand a thing of what he was saying. And then after the service was over, they wanted to know what we're doing there. And I said, we're Mennonites. We wanted to come here and see where Menno was. Yes, yes, yes. He used to preach right here. It's a Reformed church now. It's not even Doopsgezinde. And then I wanted to take a picture of this man up there in that pulpit preaching. And he said, thank you for not doing that. He says, I will put my vestments on again. So he put his vestments on again, and then I took a picture of him when he was not preaching. I thought, wow, this man has some kind of respect for reverence. So I had a good experience up there. Okay, do you see this place here? Munster. That's where the first skeleton is. And I think I'll just take time to show you. This story is such an awful story, but you can read about it for yourselves. It is so bad that whenever the government finally put this thing down, they put the dead, butchered bodies of the Anabaptist leaders in those three cages and hung them up in St. Lambert's Church. And those cages are up there to this day. Now, of course, the bodies have all rotted away, and I think those are new cages. But it's a reminder. If you let Anabaptism go, this is what will happen. And that is why we got so heavily persecuted in Europe, because of what happened in Munster. Now, it turns out that this thing at Munster was just a fringe set of Anabaptists. But for the government, they always insisted you got to have church and state, like warp and woof in fabric. You have to have the two together, because if you separate the two, it's like fabric. Everything will fall apart. And so, and when Anabaptism first came on the scene, it was a criminal offense to be an Anabaptist, not a religious kind of crime. Criminal in that you were an anarchist, and you were going to break the fabric of society. And so we need to get rid of these people. And this became the object lesson. If you don't get a hold of these people, they will take over a city and do what they did. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. This gift makes it possible for a given age, in the midst of its blithe optimism, to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. And that's a preface to what I would like to share with you with the second skeleton on Wednesday night. Okay, a little more geography. Not a very good map, but Holland over here is where these Dutch Mennonites began. Menno Simons, when he was finally buried, was buried over here. But many Mennonites fled east, especially to this area, the Vistula area. The Mennonite icon is the windmill. The Mennonites were pioneers in claiming land from the sea and using windmills to pump this water out and to reclaim farmland. Well, since they were so skilled over here, they were desired over here to do the same thing. And at one time, I think it was around 1700, this was the most populated area of Mennonites in the whole wide world. Well, then part of our story is that this got full. Mennonites have always been tolerated. And by tolerated means they were carefully controlled. What William Penn did in Pennsylvania was a new thing with the holy experiment. When we came out of Switzerland down here under the Palatinate, we were so tired of persecution when they said, you may not evangelize and you may not meet in groups of more than 20. We said, okay, just let us live. But these people became quite wealthy and prosperous, and the government had to have better control of them, and so they officially agreed not to proselyte. In fact, if anybody married outside the Mennonite church, any children of that marriage could not be Mennonite. They were not allowed to baptize anybody but their own people. Now, of course, these same people would not offer people to serve in the military, but the government found out that these are wealthy people, can generate income, and they are good money producers in taxes. And so they kept them for their taxes. But again, they multiplied, and they were at the bursting point. I'm getting ahead of myself just to introduce what's going on. That one of their neighbors up in here someplace, I don't know where she was actually from, Empress Catherine the Great, knew about these people. And when she won the war down north of the Black Sea, she says, I know who we need over here. We need these people. And then she invited them, and we'll get to that maybe later on this week. Here's another closer up. This is called the Polish Quarter. Here's Danzig. This was a special place in history. We don't need to talk about that right now, but there is an East Prussia and a West Prussia, and it's separated by this Polish Quarter. All right, there's us. There's Switzerland. We're far south. There up close is Bern. Here is Zurich. And Schleitheim is right up there, right in the southern tip of Germany. So this is where we had our origins. When the Swiss government told us to get out and we didn't get out, they finally pushed us out with a lot of pressure. We went here. And this is where we learn Pennsylvania Dutch. Pennsylvania Dutch is a dialect of High German. Now, if you go to these people, the Dutch Mennonites, they spoke Holland Dutch until they got here. And here they learned Plattdeutsch. They didn't know Plattdeutsch till they came here. Plattdeutsch was the language of the common people. And for a while, when they went to church, their preachers preached in Dutch, Holland Dutch, but they did their business and everything else in Plattdeutsch. And it's a little bit similar to some of our people who know Pennsylvania Dutch. And when they go to church, they have German. Okay, if on this map you notice that Cologne is right up here at the top. Okay, so we moved up the Rhine River, and we were tolerated here for a while, and then William Penn came to visit us, and he invited us to Pennsylvania. And once people started going, then this area got America fever, and this area emptied out. That's a story in itself. Okay, here's a close-up of Holland. Right there is Dordrecht. Up here is Pingjum, Witmarsum. And all these places are where Mennonite congregations were. Look at that. Just thick. At one time, Holland was 1/10 Mennonite, total population. And then they started moving east. Menno Simons himself, I think, is buried. Maybe it's not even on this map. Yeah, right there it is, Westenfeld. That's where he's buried. Up this way, up here is Denmark. This is Holstein, Schleswig Holstein, however that's pronounced. Okay. This is what Prussia or the northern part of Europe used to look like. A whole bunch of German states. Look at that. That looks confusing, doesn't it? There you can see East Prussia and West Prussia. Here's East Prussia, West Prussia. Here's Danzig. Believe it or not, like our brother mentioned here, when we were desperately trying to go somewhere, some of our people actually moved over here and became a part of these people. Some people Some Amish people actually moved down to the Netherlands, but were not able to maintain their identity, and they became like the rest of the people. But most of these people down here from the Palatinate came to this country in two waves. The first wave started around 1707, but then the French and Indian War came along, and it interrupted the migration. And after the French and Indian War, we had the American Revolution. And so they still couldn't come. But once those two wars were over, then we have the second migration. And you folks, my guess, okay, how many of you have Pennsylvania Amish roots sitting here? Okay, you folks came in the first migration. How many of you have roots in the second migration to Ohio and Indiana? Okay, well, you came in the second, and you're all together here. That's very interesting. Those are two different groups of people. Okay. This is a close-up of the Vistula area. Here's Danzig. Today it's called... how do you pronounce Danzig today?
I'm sorry.
Paul Yoder. Okay, tell us, is it Gazonk or... Gdansk. Yeah, Gdansk. That's how you pronounce it today. Okay. Well, take a look at this. All those places are places where there was a Mennonite congregation. And this even shows it better. And the larger those dots, the larger the Mennonite population. You can see where they were clustered. And here is Catherine the Great, the person who invited these Mennonites to Russia. And that's another story for another evening. Okay, that's enough on the geography for right now. Okay, so in the remaining time, I would just like to give you a brief overview of the story from 1535, from the time these people started, until 1875, which is the first 350 years of this story. And if you want all the details of the story, you can read those books. Okay, the Dutch-Russian story is the story of a people without this. And it's made a huge difference. This makes it clear, the two-kingdom concept right here. But the Dutch-Russian people did not have that as a part of their history. And ideas always have consequences. And sometimes it takes a while for the consequences to become obvious. Well, by now, the consequences are in for their story. And because of this absence, the Dutch-Russian people have not held to the two-kingdom concept throughout their history, and it has created embarrassing consequences for these people. After a while, they didn't even understand why they're having the problems they did, but they had huge problems. Because in Russia, when the Russian government gave them the opportunity to do everything that they wanted, they basically created a Mennonite state church, which is very different from what this teaches. When you have a Mennonite state church, you have to provide your own policeman. Now, how would you feel here at this church if Brother David here was the policeman for the area, and he has to arrest you and put you in some kind of holding tank? How would you feel about that? And it's a brother in the church. Somebody has to enforce the laws, right? Even if you're a Mennonite, it doesn't mean automatically you obey all the laws. For this Mennonite, it's really beneficial for him to see a policeman along the road every so often. Okay? Okay, so we are in the flesh and we have needs like that. Well, if Mennonites are going to run their community, you have to have some kind of enforcement agency for the law. And the only thing the Russian government did is if things got so bad that their local Mennonites couldn't take care of it, then they turned them over to the Russians. Otherwise, they took care of themselves. And it was awful, awful. Can you imagine one Mennonite beating another for discipline? When my father and my son and I were traveling throughout Belgium, we went to visit the castle at Ghent. If you have the book In the Whale's Belly, this is where this happened. And they killed 110 Anabaptists there. As I told the class earlier today, they tried killing these people outside the castle walls first. But these people had so much Gelassenheit that it's just like, wow! What glorious dying is this? I want what these people have. So the authorities were noticing that recruits were happening because of public executions. So they started killing them inside the city walls so nobody could watch it. Well, I should have showed this to you. Okay, the Anabaptists in northern Belgium here were called Flemish. They were from Flanders. And the Roman Catholic authorities were so good at their Anabaptist hunting that they destroyed completely the Anabaptists here. And by killing them, they got rid of some of them. But the rest of them fled. When they fled north and joined these people. But these people were always called the Flemish Mennonites. Up here, these are the Friesen Mennonites, and they are separate peoples. And when they started moving to Prussia, you had a Flemish church and you had Friesian church. If you went from the Flemish to the Friesian, you got excommunicated. If you went from the Friesians to the Flemish, you got excommunicated. And these people could not, they lived side by side, a little bit like Amish and Mennonites, but they could not go from one church to the other. And there's some interesting things about them. Like the Flemish, they would never stand up to preach. They always sat down to preach. And they preached with no notes. They preached in a kind of, I guess, a monotone kind of voice. And the Flemish, I think, stood up and maybe even used the pulpit. I'm not sure about that. But they were different people. And the Flemish were known as kind of a jolly kind of people. They were finer with their dress and simpler with their homes. And when he bumped into the Friesians up north, the Friesians were plain in their dress and fancy in their houses. And so that's another illustration of why they couldn't work together. Anyway, there were people right here in the Netherlands. Right in here. These are called the Waterlanders. And they noticed these Flemish and these Friesians arguing all the time, and they said, this isn't right. And we're going to just simply be more tolerant about that. And as Brother Linford was talking today, they got a hold of Menno Simons' error. Menno Simons believed in the celestial flesh. It's an embarrassment. It's wrong. Okay, these Waterlanders said, yes, that is true. It's wrong. So they just kind of disassociated with themselves. And they're the people early on who were called the Doopsgezinde. They're the ones that actually stayed in Holland. It was the Friesians and the Flemish who fled east. And these Waterlanders, they fully entered into Dutch society. There was called the Dutch Golden Age. And if you've ever seen Rembrandt or heard of Rembrandt with his pictures, he knew these Dutch Mennonites. In fact, he painted this picture. This is a very poor picture. If you go online and you look up Mennonite preacher Anslow and wife, that's an awful poor picture. It's a wonderful picture. It's a picture that's about, the original is about 6 feet wide and 7 feet tall. And it's hanging someplace in Berlin to this day. But that's a very poor rendition. And there's a little statement. I didn't bring my book. I got a whole book. It's in Dutch. And It says something like this: if only we could hear his voice. His voice is even better than the way he looks. Like, you can't paint this man's voice. But Mennonite minister Anslow and wife, done by Rembrandt. Check that out. And this picture, it's this way. This guy right here is a Mennonite. He's a merchant, Mennonite merchant. The other ones don't look like Mennonites, do they? But that's painted by Rembrandt. And you can check that out. It's available. These people, these Waterlanders, interacted with the Baptists, and they were instrumental in influencing the pilgrims who came across to Plymouth, Massachusetts. And the Baptist people today, the general Baptist people today, had their origins with these people, the Waterlanders. Well, anyway, the Flemish and the Friesen moved east because they wanted to avoid persecution, and they also thought that Dutch society was becoming too wealthy and too worldly, which means they're blaming the Waterlanders for losing their faith. Well, persecution ended. The last Dutch martyr was in 1574. That's pretty early. And because of that, the Mennonites prospered in business. They were big whalers, hunting whales up by Greenland, and merchants, just like I showed you this picture. And during this Dutch golden age, they became educated professionals. They were writers, artists, and doctors. And like I said earlier, they didn't want to be called Mennonites, they wanted to be called Doopsgezinde. And it's these Doopsgezinde are the ones who gave us our passage to America, paid our way over here. Now, at this same time, there's a young man by the name of Tielman van Braught. And he was noticing what was going on. He was noticing that the grandchildren of the martyrs were losing the martyrs' faith because everything's becoming prosperous, and that old martyr stuff is just kind of antique. And he thought, got to do something about this. So he began to assemble martyr stories. He was only 32 years old, just young, but he was a minister, and he was concerned. He saw what was happening. They collected. It was a small book, but they kept adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. Finally, it was finished in 1660, and that's the last printing, I guess. Edition, thank you, the last edition. There was one more after that, 1685, where the pictures were put in. You know, the woodcuts that we like to look at. But up to 1660, and then right before they published it, we were having all these problems over in Switzerland, and the Dutch people were petitioning the Dutch government, and the Dutch government was sending warnings up to Switzerland, stop persecuting those people. Of course, the Swiss didn't listen to them, but they added our stories to the back of the martyr's mirror. Now, our stories are only about that thick. I have a book about this thick. Now, the irony is that the Dutch-Russian Mennonites don't have martyr's mirrors. We have them. And our story is just that much. You say, what's going on here? Well, we were persecuted over the time that this was happening, and this book became precious to us and has served a huge influence down through the years for our people, not the people for whom it was written. There's some renewed effort now to, by the way, nobody's collected martyr stories and put them into a collection since 1660, except a few in the book Coals of Fire. And now there's a new book. I have three copies out there on the table, Bearing Witness. And that's just the beginning. Did you know there have been more, I don't know if I can call them Anabaptists, there are Church of the Brethren people in the country of Nigeria. There have been 10,000 martyrs there just within the last 4 years. But we know almost nothing about it. That's the last story in Bearing Witness. I think 600,000 people of the Church of the Brethren people. Now, not all these people are as thoroughly non-resistant as we would feel comfortable with, but some of them are. And they have been displaced over into Cameroon. They came in and destroyed, the Boko Haram has come in and destroyed their headquarters, and I think destroyed I don't know, hundreds of their churches. Okay, that's a story, and I don't want to get sidetracked there. Okay, back to these Mennonites. As I said, at one time there were 1/10 of the population of Holland. They had 160,000 members in 1700, just after the Golden Age. But by 1820, get that, in 120 years, they were down to 30,000. They mushroomed in the numbers, and then they collapsed like that. They lost 100 congregations in 100 years. Why? Well, I'll conclude tonight with the reasons, and then I'll sit down. This is not original with me. This source lists six reasons why the Dutch Mennonites grew rapidly but declined in numbers and spirituality just as rapidly. Number one, worldliness. The prosperity and affluence of these diligent people inclined them to upward social mobility. Thus, it became easy to want to be like the world. Number two, there was a stigma of being Mennonite. The possibility of upward social mobility was hampered by the stigma of their religion with its uniqueness of simplicity, austerity, and non-resistance. Thus, being Mennonite did not fit with the direction they were moving. Number three, ungodly education. The youth were educated in a system which did not honor God. The education was deemed necessary for the progress of the next generation. Number four, men refused ordination. It did not pay to preach. So in a time when prosperity was abundantly available, men refused ordination in favor of occupation. And number five, seminaries were developed to train ministers and church leaders. These institutions became theologically liberal. Thus, they did the opposite of what they were intended to do. And number six, the non-resistance was lost. The Dutch Mennonites became involved in political process. Their patriotism did not allow them to continue the non-resistant position. And in World War II, there were only three Mennonite conscientious objectors in Holland. When it comes to Germany, which is the part is our story for Wednesday night, there were zero. And this book right here, Mennonite German Soldier, is a book that details what happened and how it happened that they lost their non-resistance from 1772 to 1880. That thick shows how they lost it a little bit at a time, so that by World War I, they were ready to go fight. Thank you for your attention.